Picture yourself standing on top of a diving board. You have stood on top of this diving board many times before today. You know the treads that wind their way up its hard column, the history of the divers who have gone before you written on them in wet footprints. You know the railing that wraps its way around the outside, paint beaten off it by years of sun and chlorinated hands. And you know the place at the top, the place where the stairs end and a plane begins, a plane of rubber paint and no slip strips, a plane that leads out to the place where the railing ends and nothing starts. There is no actual board on the diving board. It is a pair of concrete slabs sticking out of the round spire, a giant F at the end of the swimming pool. But a diving board, the diving board, is what you and your friends call it. You have stood on top of this diving board many times before today. What you have never done is jump. Previous visits to the summit have gotten you as far as the edge, and there you have stood dead still, looking down, measuring the drop, your hand digging a hole in the railing. It is as though you were looking at the water through a pair of binoculars turned backwards. It was impossibly, lethally far away. And in that moment, which seemed like an hour or more as you waited, your friends on the deck below would begin to shout, to call out your name, to say, jump, or go, to ask you questions. The lifeguard would look up at you, impatience flashing in her eyes, her hands reaching for her megaphone. Even in the summer sun, the wind was cold. And then there was the trip back down. Your embarrassed footprints, the only ones facing the wrong direction. This is the history that you hold with you on top of the diving board. You would not be there today if it were not for this kid. The two of you met in the shallow, and his hair is wild. There's something in his eyes you can't name. You spent a while whipping volleyballs at each other's heads, but then he popped out of the water and started heading for the diving board. "Follow me," he said, and so you did. Down the length of the pool, you went walking, not running, past the lifeguard, until you reached the stairs and started climbing. The kid is climbing hard and fast. You have to work to keep up with him. He's talking the whole time. His words ricochet down the stairs at you. You think you hear him say, "Foxes have holes and birds have nests." And then you are at the top. At the summit, you have gone past the first part of the F and to the very top. You are at the place where there is nothing but the railing and the summer sky, infinity. The kid sets his face towards the end of the diving board, towards glory and terror, and he starts into his run. "Wait! Wait," you say. "I have to call my dad." "Forget your dad," the kid says. "Let your dad call himself." And then he is off the end, out into the air. He hangs there for a moment. Gravity is suspended, sitting there with nothing beneath him, Wile E. Coyote. Except there is no look of confusion on his face, no little sign in his hand. There's just the kid and his eyes. And then those eyes turn and look at you, "Follow me." And then the gravity is back and he is gone, down into the water below. And you realize, in this moment, the wall that has held you back, that has kept you from stepping off the diving board, that has pushed you back down the stairs all those other times, is gone. If you wanted, you could step off the end and into something new. "Follow me," "What?" you whisper. "You mean now?" We spend a lot of our lives hoping for change, praying for a change, waiting for a difficult neighbor or a classmate or a coworker or fellow parishioner to leave, waiting for love to come into our lives, waiting for a baby to be born, waiting for the movie or the flight or school to end, waiting for the church to get its act together, waiting for the new government to come. We want change, we want a chance, we want the opportunity to follow Jesus. But then Jesus walks into town, the new sheriff, the spurs on his sandals clinking on the dirt road, and we're suddenly not so sure. I mean, yes, Jesus, this is what I want. I want to follow you. I just didn't think you were coming today. The Son of God is a lot of things, priest and prophet and healer and symbol, but maybe what he is most of all is teacher. Jesus is always teaching in one way or another. Today he is teaching in a way that only the really great teachers can get away with. He is being righteously, intemperately impatient with us as we offer our excuses for why we cannot follow him, why we cannot take a holy risk. He is listening to our reasons, and he is calling BS. And here's the thing that's hard about this. Our reasons for not going today are actually pretty good. I have a family. I've got responsibilities. I have a mortgage to pay. I have to plow my field. I have to bury my father. But Jesus is having none of it. Let the dead bury their own dead. This makes a case for being the harshest thing that Jesus ever says in the Gospels, the most callous thing that he ever says. It rivals the time that he likens the Canaanite woman to a dog. He never says anything this harsh to Pilate. And I suspect that Jesus is speaking in this way to this young man because he knows that the young man actually doesn't have a corpse at home. That burying the dead, burying his father, is something that is going to happen years from now or decades from now. It is the reason that this young man cannot follow Jesus, the reason that he cannot say yes to calling, the reason that he cannot take a risk. And Jesus knows that this kind of reason, well, it can move our calling into a box called someday, which turns effortlessly into never. I suspect that Jesus knows this. I suspect that Jesus is speaking harshly as a teacher as a consequence, because I've had a teacher speak to me this way. I've received the difficult gift of a teacher speaking to me impatiently, of giving me an unwelcome and necessary gift out of safety and stability and home, an unwelcome and necessary push out of the tragedy which is the life unlived. I resented that teacher for speaking to me that way. I might have hated him for a while, but I'm grateful for it now. The Israeli physicist Moshe Feldenkrais says the world is full of people longing for change, but on one condition: we don't want anything to be different. Feldenkrais named something really profound and human with that line. We long for change and we want things to remain as they are. And so, like the smoker or the drunk who knows that they need to stop, we are committed to the change, just not now. I'll stop in a week or in a month, just when I get past this hard patch. And maybe we are disinclined to change because we know that stepping off the diving board is a kind of death. It is an ending of our fear and of our certainty. These things will be replaced with what? We don't know. With maybe a worse fear, one that this time we cannot control. Maybe with a belly flop, like that kid we heard about one time who hit the water sideways. His body made the sound like an oar striking the water on its side. He walked funny for a year afterwards. Or maybe by something else. Something that comes in the rush of the wind and the water coming up at us fast. We stand on the diving board, shivering in the cold summer wind, and from down below, the voices come up to us asking questions. These are the great questions of childhood. They are the great questions of life. Who do you think you are? What are you afraid of? Picture yourself standing on top of a diving board. You have stood on this board many times before today, but what you have never done is jump off of it. Down in the water below, the kid with the wild hair is slowly swimming away, making room for you. From way up here, it almost looks like he's walking on the water. And then he turns and looks at you with those eyes. And across the din of the pool, across all of the shouting, across all of the other noise, you can make out his words. Follow me.